Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. Hope you're doing well. This is Cliff, your host, and welcome to Earth Ancients. We've been playing around with HD the last couple of months, and our program last week seemed to have some challenging moments where our guest was not really clear. Coming through clear, and I think what I decided to do after speaking to a number of technicians is to switch off the HD until the station has it together. So this program is not in HD, but I think you'll enjoy it much more because you can hear, and we've actually tested this a couple of times. I think the quality will be a little bit better in a normal setting. I don't think there'll be any change. HD is great with music, with certain pre-recordings, but the standard settings are working great. So a few apologies for some of the inconsistencies of recording and audio. So there you go. We're working with what we got. I want to talk a little bit this morning about some of the people who have been kind of unhappy with the fact that I don't promote Ancient Aliens. The Ancient Aliens series is fantastic in many ways. The location shoots, some of the ruins are just beautifully photographed. But I've stated it many times. Their premise is that anything that's anomalous, anything that is unexplainable, is the work of ancient aliens, aliens who came to the Earth and disseminated knowledge to us. Now, I don't disagree with that premise because obviously we've had people that have followed up in Zachariah Sitchin's work, 12th Planet, the Earth Chronicles, and there's a number of authors who we've featured that do touch on an alien influence. But my problem, and I'm just going to say it very quickly because I've repeated it a number of times, my problem with ancient aliens is that anything that they reveal, that could be the Great Pyramid of Giza, it could be Baalbek in Lebanon, the ruins at Chichen Itza, Easter Island, and so on, are the handiwork of aliens. So I just have been studying the subject, have interviewed and worked with and actually produced a number of programs in the 90s, conferences around lost civilizations. And my belief is there's, and a number of other authors and investigators' belief is that there's a missing part of our history. There's a part of history where there were earlier civilizations that were sophisticated close to us, and maybe even more so, that developed and thrived and populated the planet with their science and technology. And I believe that many, if not most, of the remains on Earth, a good many of them, are from an Earth-based civilization. Because we cannot find writing from them at this point, isn't an excuse to defer them to to aliens. And I have quite a few people upset with me that I don't embrace the alien theories and embrace the ancient alien program. Well, that's not what Earth Ancients is all about. I've made that clear a number of times. And the thing is, I'm one to embrace the alien mythologies that we have. The Mayans have a mythology of working with star people. The Hopi Indians do. The Dogon people of Africa do. Robert Temple wrote about it in his book. But the thing is, it's too easy to simply say that Earth was early Earth man was influenced by aliens, and that the great structures of the Earth, the places I talked about, ancient ruins, are the work of aliens. So I want to clarify that in the beginning here, because on our Facebook page, I post quite a bit of references to different authors who are, may talk about an alien influence. There's a lot of interesting possibilities. The people of Paracas, Peru, these very strange, elongated cranial skeletons of a people who are not with us any longer. There's no evidence of anyone living like that who has these kind of elongated skulls. And it's easy to say these are alien skulls. Well, people say they're alien because there's no references to humanoid or Homo sapien skulls like that. But it's my belief, and a number of other investigators believe, that this is a form of humanoid that died out. We don't know why they died out. And that's the big question I always have. You hear about people like Brian Forrester, who's down in Peru, who's claiming these are aliens, and he's on Ancient Alien TV saying, oh, these are aliens, and take a look at their skull. They're not like anything we've ever seen before. And it's my feeling that until we get some solid anatomical and forensic evidence to understand these people, where they are in the evolutionary chain, if they're human. I mean, I guess they could be alien, but see, I'm questioning it right now. So, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that there's millions and millions of websites. Excuse me, there's thousands of websites that are UFO, that are alien, and they're alien abduction. And I mean, that's one branch of thinking. And my focus is on ancient, lost, and known and unknown civilizations of Earth. So I'm going to put that to rest right now. So there you go. I wanted to go over a couple of areas on the website, on the Facebook website, that I think are of interest. I want to also mention that about a year ago, I started producing short vignette videos of ruins around the world that go back into antiquity. And I posted a recent one, the sacred city of Dodoma, and the temple of Apollo. And this is a very interesting place. They actually dated to the Neolithic period. But the thing is, scientists that and the archaeologists who actually reassembled it believe that it goes very, very far back into prehistory, to the point where they really can't date it. All they can date are the ruins of the people who built the Temple of Apollo, until it was destroyed by the Persians in 494 BC, it was continually used for thousands and thousands of years. So it's a video. It was I created it about 2 years ago, and I really strongly urge you to take a look at it, because the photographs that I have in there are unique in that the photographer was allowed to go into a number of the some of the tunnels, which are partly destroyed, but actually show megalithic construction on a very high scale, cut and polished stone, some weighing 5 to 20 tons, are part of this architecture, and it actually makes us think of megalithic builders, which is something that is quite prevalent in places like Baalbek and Giza. Makes us think that there could have been a megalithic period where these giant stones were cut in some fashion using a technology we don't know. So take a look at that. That was posted a few days ago. And then the other thing is, of course, you know, Maya, all things Maya are of interest to me. Central America is a huge interest to me. A archaeologist who posts quite a bit of material on our site, Facebook, Earth Ancients Facebook page, Lori Cash, discovered a quite unique figurine in the Jalna Island in Mexico, which is just off of the Yucatan Peninsula. And this figure, I've never seen anything quite like him. He has distinct Caucasian features, has an unusual hair style, but what's really unique about him is he has what looks like tattoos on his face, but it's a form of scarring of the face and the raising of these symbols. And his entire face is filled with the symbology that appears to be snakes and planetary bodies. And by the way, he's got a goatee and a mustache too, which is quite unusual. And so I posted this a couple of days ago, it's one of the most unique sculptures I've ever seen. The other thing is kind of weird. It looks like he's sitting on a chariot. Now, it's some kind of seat structure, which may be missing its wheels, but it's hard to say. I haven't been able to get a hold of Lori to tell me where she had that photograph taken. It looks like it's in some museum, but that whole Gulf Coast part of the Yucatan is filled with a very unusual strain of Maya, more culturally and diverse than any other area that I've ever seen. Asiatic, African, Caucasian, or European figurines are just very plentiful there. So take a look at that. You can find it on Earth Ancients Facebook page, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. I always discuss the most recent postings. I really suggest that you take a look at that page and keep an eye on it, because it's where we post most of our research. My guest today is Laird Scranton, and Laird's been with us a couple of different times. We had him on when he had a book on Chinese cosmology, and then again, one of my favorite subjects was when he wrote a book on Velikovsky. Velikovsky Heresies. And Laird is a prolific writer. It seems like I get a press release from his publisher, Inner Traditions, every other month, and all of a sudden it's, Laird has a new book. So, but this new book is called Point of Origin, and the very first program we had, which relates to this book, was with John Anthony West, and the focus of that program initially was the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure and these megaliths that were built there. But towards the end of that program, John was quite adamant about speaking about a place in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe, and he referenced it for not only the great age of the place, which was, I believe it's between 10 and 12,000 years, but the importance of the megaliths, the carvings, and Göbekli Tepe's place in history. Since that time, we've had Andrew Collin speak about his book on the subject, and Andrew spoke in depth on his belief that this was a structure that was created by the survivors of a great cataclysm to teach the remaining or the survivors of this cataclysm to educate them in the various farming, agriculture, and basic sciences to basically restart or kickstart civilization. That was a fantastic book. That book was called Genesis of the Gods. And the interesting thing about that is that he suggests that a group, possibly the Anunnaki or the alien beings, were at the root of that. I tend to question those assumptions, but it's a fascinating book anyhow. Laird's book, on the other hand, tends to pull together. And by the way, Laird's a fantastic writer when it comes to comparative work. So his foundations are in the work of the Dogon people of Africa, Hindu, Chinese, and just a lot of rich culture and how they all compare, comparative research, comparative study. And Laird Scranton is a recognized authority on the Dogon mythology and symbolism. And he is the author of The Science of the Dogon and Dogon and the Chinese Cosmological Prehistory. And he's coming to us today from Albany, New York. And the weather today is cold, my friend, or is it balmy and things are warming up? How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you very much for having me on. Well, one of the advantages to having the kind of winter that we've had where temperatures go so consistently below zero is that we get a day like today where the temperatures are up in the high 20s and it feels like spring has arrived.
It's the high 20s. Okay. Now, I think everyone I talked to on the East Coast has suffered this year, this winter, and we're about to enter tomorrow daylight savings time, so I would think that means longer days, more sun, and hopefully some melting. Is that what you're all hoping for there?
Yes, I think our 10-day forecast is to be above freezing every day this week. I think it's going to dip down below freezing in the evenings, but at least maybe we'll get some hopefully slow melting of the several feet of snow we have stacked everywhere. We're lucky compared to Boston and Buffalo, who got hit really hard this year, but Albany is sort of positioned strategically. We ended up not getting too much.
It's perfect weather for writing, isn't it, Laird? I mean, it's you can't really go anywhere, so you just hamper down and start just working on the computer as long as you have electricity.
Yes, you're right. It really does lend itself to clean up projects around the house and doing things on the computer and writing and research and all that.
Let me ask you, I'm fascinated with Göbekli Tepe, as well as many people are. What did you see in this structure? And by the way, before I ask you this question, did you have a chance to read Andrew Collins' book on Göbekli Tepe and have a see how he relates the structure to his potential purpose?
Yes, I did. I have a copy of his book, and I read it, and I've met Andrew before. He seems like a really mm-hmm. interesting guy, and he and I seem to connect on a number of different levels, in person at least, and I enjoyed his mm-hmm. book quite a bit. I was only a little concerned with my publisher that the cover, which is also his publisher, that the cover they picked mm-hmm. for my book is so resembles his book so much. If I had been him, I would not have been pleased about that.
Hmm. Well, once you open the book, it's a different take. Now, you spend quite a bit of time in the first part of this book relating to the cosmology of the Dogon, the Chinese, and I'm curious what it is, or what it was about. The Göbekli Tepe structure that really gave you some kind of insight or made you feel that you needed to write about it as related to the other studies that you have. What was the, I mean, we know about the megaliths. We know about the structure is very, very old. But what was it that triggered you to a level where you thought there's something here that I have to really research?
Well, before I answer that, one thing I want to point out is something that Graham Hancock says in an endorsement he wrote for the book. He points out that the book is not so much about Göbekli Tepe as it is about trying to place what we find at Göbekli Tepe into a larger framework. So I don't mm-hmm. want a reader to be disappointed if they buy the book thinking this is going to be all about Göbekli Tepe. It's not. That's not the primary subject. But it is a starting point conceptually. Now, what brought me into the subject matter was my friends John Anthony West and Robert Schock were planning a trip to Göbekli Tepe on site to be able to examine the megaliths. And John had arranged for a gathering of people at his house the night before, which I was coming to. And in preparation for that, I had done some study of the carved images of animals that are on the megaliths and noticed that a large number of those animals are significant in the cosmologies, the creation traditions that I study, that the animals symbolize certain aspects of creation. But there were a couple of animals there that I wasn't aware of having symbolism in those creation traditions. And I was interested to find out why those were being depicted if my presumption was that this was a cosmological set of symbols. And so I did some research. One of the things that happens, okay, Göbekli Tepe is so old that it actually predates the first evidence we have of the tools that would have been required to build it. It's really, really old. Mm-hmm. And it's about 7,000 years before the advent of written language, so we don't have written text to go to. But what I've noticed in my studies is that the farther back in time we go, the more commonality of language we have, that the more the words were the same. So I decided to look up the names of these animals that are depicted on the megaliths at Göbekli Tepe in an Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary. And I discovered that all of the animal names, including the animals I didn't think had significance in the creation tradition, the names are pronounced like important terms of the cosmology, important terms of the creation tradition. The words are homonyms for things like words that mean gravity or light or mass or matter or things like that. So the perspective I came to that gathering at John's house with was that these might represent a kind of proto-writing, where a hunter-gatherer who didn't know how to read or write would walk up to the megalith, see the image of an animal whose name he knew, and when he spoke that name, he was also speaking the term of cosmology that he might have been instructed about at that spot.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of my entry point into it.
Okay.
the main goal of the book, starting out, was to try to put Göbekli Tepe into a context. There are so many elements there displayed at the site in Turkey that are reminiscent of things we see at 3000 BC with the classic ancient cultures like ancient Egypt and ancient India and ancient China and places like that. For example, you've got pictures of scorpions and serpents and animals that became iconic symbols of gods or of pharaohs or rulers at 3000 BC, that there seemed like there was a likely connection there between, despite the 7,000-year span of time, it seemed like there was a connection between those two, and I wanted to try to sort that out. Now, because we don't have writing, it makes it very, very difficult to do what I call anchoring and interpretation. My rule for myself, because human brains are wired to see patterns whether they exist or not, and that's a problem for a researcher like me who's trying to find correct interpretations about things. How do you protect yourself from your own wishful imaginings? And so the way I protect myself is I normally require that each interpretation start with a clear statement on the part of the culture I'm studying, and I usually get those statements from written texts. But if you're dealing with a culture that's long before the start of writing, how do you do that? How can you start an interpretation by saying, here's what the culture thought? That sort of removes it from the arena of, here's Laird Scranton's idea. This isn't Laird Scranton's idea. This is the idea of the Buddhist or the idea of the Dogon or whoever it happens to be. So I was looking for ways to be able to do that. And language provided me with some ways of doing that. One key was this tendency of words to be more and more common between cultures as you go back in time. Preparing for this gathering at John's house, I also explored the Turkish word tepe and discovered that in the Turkish language, the modern Turkish language, there are upwards of like 25 different meanings for that word tepe. And then I went to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary from around, 2000 BC, and it represents words from around 2000 BC, and discovered that at least a dozen of those two dozen meanings I could find reflected in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, same meaning, very similar pronunciation. And what that said to me was that when people back in ancient times in Turkey were using the word tepe, they meant the same things that the more modernized Egyptians meant by it. Mm-hmm. So that got me thinking, well, could there be connections between the Egyptians have this cultural memory of what they call the first time. This is an era long in their past that was what they referred to justify any decision they made or any important judgment they made. They would always refer back to this revered mythical time that they called the first time, but they all in their language they referred to it as Zep Tepe. And so I wondered, could the Tepe and Zep Tepe be the same tepe as in Göbekli Tepe? So those were sort of my entry points, the pictures of the animals and the language. Mm-hmm. The name Göbekli Tepe is traditionally translated as Potbelly Hill. But there are, because each of the component words can have, two dozen meanings, you can create a lot of different possible interpretations for what that word means.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Do you find that the ruins of Göbekli Tepe are an influence for other cultures, or do you find that other cultures influence Göbekli Tepe? You reference the Dogon, Chinese, Hindu, Egyptian, it's just interesting that, and I'm going to ask you a little bit later, who do you think these influencers may have been, if you believe it's a Robert Temple kind of a thing where it's could be off-world people or an unseen group of people, but what do you think the influence of that place is, if there is one?
Well, in the perspective of the cultures that I study, when you get down to the bottom of it, there's a common belief, and the belief is that certain civilizing skills, which were tagged to certain scientific concepts, were instructed to humanity a very long time ago by someone who knew more than we did. The Dogons say that, the Buddhists say that. For example, when the Egyptians refer to a first, quote-unquote, first time, the Buddhists refer to a first time that knowledge was passed to humanity by a Buddha. So there's this common thread in these ancient cultures that there was instruction that happened in ancient times. And many of the cultures describe, in general terms, where that instruction happened. The common thread there is that it happened in high mountaintop sanctuaries at some remote locale. That is, it's not specified, you know, where that locale was, but the upshot of it is that a few members of a tribal group were taken away to a remote locale and instructed in civilizing skills and concepts of science and sent back to instruct everybody else. And so all around the world, South America and elsewhere, we have this tradition of eight mythical or quasi-mystical ancestor teachers who come and bring skills of civilization like agriculture and weaving and metalworking and stoneworking and pottery and things like that. So at Göbekli Tepe at 10,000 BC, in that same general region that Göbekli Tepe is situated, we find the first evidence of cultivated grains. We find the first evidence of metallurgy. Göbekli Tepe is our first sign of stoneworking and stone carving and megalithic stone structures. We've got the first evidence there of animal husbandry, which is, you know, farmers keeping cattle and sheep. So all in one locale, we've got a set of evidence that sort of supports that idea that maybe these skills were all instructed in one general region in ancient times. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the starting point for this. But the trick is, how do you connect what we find at Göbekli Tepe forward to these other cultures? It looks as if there should be connections. But without writing, how do you tag it? So
right.
In the book that I wrote about China, I have a similar situation where there's a lack of textual evidence to support what happened at 3000 BC. And so I've got to do comparisons to languages of other cultures and to other kinds of evidence to try to support interpretations. What I did here was I looked at, I asked myself what the ancient Egyptian name was for the region in which Göbekli Tepe is found, where it's situated. Now, there was a Greek term for it. It was called Cappadocia. But there was also an ancient Egyptian term that was that, according to the E.A. Wallace Budge, the guy who wrote the Egyptian dictionary back in the early 1900s, he pronounces it Get Pet Kai. And I know that over the, you know, with a passage of 7,000 years, Get Pet Kai is a pretty fair phonetic equivalent to Göbekli. It's possible that Get Pet Kai survived in Turkey as Göbekli.
Mm-hmm.
This name for that region is sort of an archaic word form. It doesn't follow the rules of later language. And so I had to sort of educate myself a little bit about how these archaic words work. But the word begins with a glyph that looks like a little picture of a shrine. And it ends with a glyph that looks like a picture of mountains. And so I took that as an indication that this might be the name of a mountaintop sanctuary. And the glyphs that fell in between that are pronounced Get Pet Kai, I could sort out enough to make it understandable to myself that it looked like it was a temple that was dedicated to two Egyptian gods, Pet or Ptah and Ka. These are the names of two known Egyptian gods from later times. Later on, I figured out, by comparing to some other similar words that look like they're also the names of sanctuaries, that this name should really be formulated in terms of three god names. And I was comparing it to another sanctuary that was called Ganusa-Ast. Now, that's the archaic pronunciation. But the same glyphs that are used to write it in its archaic form also have pronunciations that are more modernized. And so I asked myself, what happens if you update the pronunciation of these things? And what happens in that case is that Ganusa'ast becomes Het Penusa'ast. Het means temple. Sa is a word for Orion. Ast is a word for Isis or Sirius. And Penu was a word I didn't recognize. But I surmise that if the other two represent astronomic bodies, Penu must represent one also. And I also know from my studies in cosmology that the astronomic body that associates with Orion and Sirius in sort of a triad is a spiral, an almost invisible spiral out there that spirals around the belt stars of Orion called Barnard's Loop.
Mm-hmm.
So I use this word Penu that I didn't understand to try to trace forward how do we connect, go back with Tepe forward. And that word Penu brought me to an archaic cult in India that has all of the same iconic elements that we see at Göbekli Tepe. They're characterized by high mountaintop sanctuaries, by standing stones, by animals that symbolize concepts, by circles of stones, and by something that's called like a little clay pot filled with water that represents a womb. It's called a pot belly. Well, I know Göbekli Tepe, is translated as pot belly hill. So we've got now multiple crossing sort of affirmations here that the connection ought to be to this cult in India called the Shakti cult.
Well, let's talk about the Shakti cult. That was a point I was going to bring up. What it's the Shakti cult of Orissa, right? Orissa.
Yeah, there's a region in India called Orissa. It's on the sort of the east coast of the pointed peninsula down in the southern part of India. But the cult originated to the northeast or the northwest in the direction of where Göbekli Tepe actually is.
Right, but these are goddesses. These are gods and goddesses. There's no actual people that are related to this Shakti cult, as far as I've read from your work.
No, there are the Tamil group is the one that that preserves this tradition. It's associated mm-hmm. with a region in India that's populated by the Tamil, who are they also brought down sort of an ancient language called the Dravidian language.
So there is a physical group that's related to this cult.
And a modern-day group, one that goes way back in time, that goes back so far that they can't trace how far back it goes. Mm-hmm. But just as the word of the first sanctuary name I came up with, Get Petkai, could have survived in Turkey as Göbekli. Also, the name for the second sanctuary, which is Ganusa'ast, the first piece of that might easily have survived in India as Ganesha. So, another point of confirmation that I had found the right archaic group to link this to is that the Shakti cult centers on two mother goddesses who are understood to be the mothers of Ganesha, the elephant god in India. The dancing elephant god. And
right.
So I began educating myself about the traditions in the Shakti cult, and I discovered that they had all the right stuff to connect back historically to Göbekli Tepe and to connect forward to the other cultures I study. It's known to be ancestral to the Vedic tradition and the Hindu and the Buddhist and the Hindu traditions in India. But they've also got symbolism that connects to ancient Egypt at around 4,000 BC down at a place called Elephantine at the first cataract or waterfall of the Nile River. This is an island. And that symbolism all plays out in terms of items and words that are icons of Ganesha, even though there is no elephant god in Egypt to anyone's knowledge. There's all sorts of elephant symbolism down around Elephantine that ties back to two sister mother goddesses comparable to the two goddesses in India. There are myths with this tradition in India. If you know any ancient Egypt, there's a famous myth about the god Osiris where he's tricked he's trapped inside a casket and then dismembered, cut up into parts that are scattered all around Egypt. And then, depending on the myth you believe, either Isis, his wife, or Horus, his son, gathers those pieces back together and reconstitutes them to recreate him. Well, in India, in this archaic tradition that I'm pursuing, the same myth exists with all the same essential elements, but it doesn't happen to a god, it happens to a goddess named Sati. As a matter of fact, pretty much everything that in ancient Egypt at 3000 BC that relates to gods, when you get to the era between 3000 BC and 10,000 BC, it all relates to goddesses, not gods. You have a matriarchal tradition that's archaic that somehow reversed itself, not just in Egypt, but in all sorts of different regions at about the same time, where what had previously been framed around goddesses suddenly was now centered on gods.
Is it your feeling that there's something about Göbekli Tepe that is a great influence that is spread out to these other cultures that you studied?
Yes, the authorities that I read, who are my sources for the Shakti cult information, document DNA studies and language studies and cultural studies that that show influences spreading from the Fertile Crescent area where Göbekli Tepe is located outward, sort of radiating outward. And they go south and east as far as Australia. They go south and west into Africa. They go north and east into Asia. And they go north and west as far as Europe. So
that's amazing.
There are cultural studies that support the idea that things originated there.
And what is your feeling after finishing this book as to who were these individuals who built these tepes, this facility that, as far as I can see, what you've written about is a learning center of some kind?
Yes, an instructional center, basically. Now, okay, I had been talking about the principle that I had to establish for myself in order to filter out wishfulness, that if two or more cultures cross-confirm, you know, overt statements about what they say was true about a symbol or a concept, that's my starting point for an interpretation. Now, the downside of that is that if two or more cultures affirm something that I'm not really happy about, an interpretation that I don't necessarily agree with, I'm also obligated to at least consider it, because that's my standard for how interpretations work. Now, the difficulty I have in terms of Göbekli Tepe is that the Buddhists flatly say that the most sacred of their symbols were given to them by a non-human source. And the Dogon flatly say their tradition was given to them by a non-human source, but they go an additional step and they say not only was it non-human, it was also non-material. Now, that's a difficult statement to get your arms around until you start tracing how, where this tradition goes philosophically. Philosophically, when they talk about how matter is formed, which is one of the themes of these creation traditions, you get down to the bottom of it, and they define the existence of a pair of universes, not a single universe. That they say that our material universe is paired with a non-material universe. Now, scientifically, that might connect to concepts of things like dark matter. In other words, there are things that exist out there that we can't see, according to the Dogon and according to the Buddhists. Now, in the way they conceptualize this stuff, when that non-material universe comes into close contact with the material universe, a byproduct of those two things coming together is essentially a reflected image that we see as our material universe, that what we're looking at is akin to a hologram or a projected television show sort of thing. We're looking, according to the Dogon, we're looking at a correct reflection of a more fundamental reality, but that it's just a reflection. This is what we're seeing is not the real bottom of the line thing. This is just a reflected image. So the suggestion is that influences from this non-material side, and according to the Dogon and the Buddhists, the non-material universe, this is difficult to explain, when Einstein talks about mass, the greater the more massive a body becomes, the slower its time frame is. That's how the speed of light stays constant, even if you accelerate it. Acceleration is equivalent to mass. That even if you accelerate as fast as you can go, the speed of light always stays the same speed ahead of you. And the only way that can happen is if time slows down. So in this non-material universe, which is a massless universe, because it's massless compared to ours, the time frame that it exists in has to be running at a sort of an infinitely fast pace compared to ours. And so effectively all events happen at once. And according to the Dogen and the Buddhists, the non-material side has perfect knowledge, but because they don't have the duration of time, they don't have the ability to act. The material side has imperfect knowledge, but perfect ability to act. And so the idea is that there are these subtle influences that cross from the non-material side to the material side that I sort of compare to a game of charades. It's sort of subtle influences to try to induce actions on the material side that the non-material side can't take for themselves. Now, according to the Dogen, whoever created this instructed system in ancient times had originally been non-material, but there was enough of a material presence in our universe that they were concerned about what the bad side effects might be of their influences on us, long-term contact with us. And so their solution to that was to sequester 8 tribes people at a remote location, teach just those 8, send those 8 back to teach everybody else, and now they've limited the exposure of them to only 8 of us. That was their solution. That's the reason for the remote sanctuary idea. So if I credit what the Buddhists and the Dogen say, who are really the best, from my standpoint, have done the best job of keeping this tradition straight, I have to allow for the possibility that we had a non-human influence at Göbekli Tepe that was trying to help us out. I see it as being akin to FEMA coming in after a disaster or the Peace Corps coming in after a disaster. The Egyptians talk about the first time. The Buddhists talk about the first time instruction was passed to humanity. The Dogen talk about a time when humanity was restored to culture. And so the idea is that the Ice Age sits as this sort of gigantic calamity that happened to humanity that sort of bumped us back to the Stone Age and from what might have been higher culture prior to the Ice Age. And that some unnamed group, mounted an effort to come in and help us get back on our feet. And the way they tried to do that was teaching us basic skills of agriculture and of civilization.
Okay, well, that's what leads to my next question. Is it your belief, as it is Colin, that the people who were the instructors, teachers, the influencers were a group who had survived a catastrophic event and wanted to kickstart humanity?
No, my outlook is more that the students were the people who survived the catastrophic event, and the teachers were somebody who didn't actually have to go through it, so somebody off planet from our standpoint. But from the Dogen perspective, not just off planet, but sort of stepped outside our universe.
Interesting. You reference Schwaller de Lubitsch, his book, The Egyptian Miracle, An Introduction to the Wisdom of the Temple. Of course, John Anthony West wrote a whole book about him, which was called Serpent in the Sky. Is
right.
There something like that imbued at Göbekli Tepe? De Lubitsch references these amazing buildings as embodying this energy. Do you find that's the same for Göbekli Tepe?
Göbekli Tepe I see as being sort of an initial trial run at trying to get this system of cosmology. This is a very complicated system of symbols and words and structures and things like that at 3000 BC. And I see at 10,000 BC at Göbekli Tepe sort of a first try at that, and not always successful try at that. And then as you get down closer to 3000 BC, you see certain reversals and reformulations of things that sort of tie it together into a more coherent system. For instance, the symbolism of this word Penu, which I associate with this big spiral out in the universe there called Barnard's Loop, was originally associated symbolically with the tail of a mouse that curls. Now, as you get down to 3000 BC, somebody changes that Ganesha, the elephant god, the head he has of an elephant is not his original head. And the suggestion is that it was originally that of a mouse. It looks like there was a reversal that happened, that somebody reframed that in terms of myth to associate a very large animal with a very large structure that's in the universe above us, rather than very small animal. They were trying to get consistency here in symbolism, so that if we see a large animal, we think of a large structure. It's sensible. So I see crossing cultures. As you approach 3000 BC, you see these tweakings and reversals and subtle changes in symbolism that happen. For example, for me, the falcon god Horus in Egypt originally represented the concept of a symbol. And then later on, his symbolism gets changed. Suddenly, he's the son of Osiris and Isis, the way that Ganesha is the son of Siva and Sati in the tradition that comes out of India. And there are different versions of these myths that happen. One of Ganesha's titles is He Who Has Two Mothers. So in the original archaic tradition, Siva, the god, wasn't involved. There were two mothers that somehow managed to create Ganesha from clay, the way that Geppetto creates Pinocchio from wood. And they breathe life into him the same way that the fairy in Pinocchio breathes life into Pinocchio. A lot of these themes that play forward into Disney cartoons and other places are really very ancient themes. So, I don't see the Göbekli Tepe people, the instructors at Göbekli Tepe, as having been survivors of an earlier culture. I see the students as having been the survivors of the earlier culture.
Is there, in your book, you have kind of an evolution of symbology, animal symbols and some letters and things like that. Did you discover through your research that Göbekli Tepe is like a starting point with the symbology of animals that is carried on in Tibet, India, and Egypt, and China? Or what is your feeling about that? I mean, it seems to me that you're trying to make a connection, as this is maybe one of the many, or maybe the university that populates the world with specific important symbols.
It looks to me as if there may have been more than one of these. There may have been regional sanctuaries. I mean, one of the translated names for Göbekli Tepe is Central Hill. Now, that's also a translated word, a translated meaning of the suffix opolis in Greece. And all the temples in ancient Greece were situated up on centralized hills. Similar things happened in Egypt. A lot of times some of the earliest temples were situated in a centralized location, maybe on higher ground. But so you can connect things linguistically that way. But the animal images, because the animal images, so many of them survived playing important roles in later culture, and because they have very clear meanings in terms of the cosmology, it looks to me like those animal images existed from very early times. You can see them at Göbekli Tepe, but a serpent has the same meaning in South America that it does in the Fertile Crescent, essentially. So unless you're going to postulate that somebody bothered to bring, you know, trainees all the way from Peru to the Fertile Crescent, you have to imagine that there might have been other regional, you know, sort of centralized regional sanctuaries where things were taught. Now, as time goes on, the book that will follow on to Point of Origin, which was just submitted this week to Inner Traditions, describes a later incarnation of an instructual sanctuary very similar to this, that dates from around 3200 BC, that sort of continues the tradition, but more in the vein of what we see at 3000 BC with dynastic Egypt. And you can see some of the differences that go back and forth between Göbekli Tepe and that later sanctuary. But you've got places in Turkey like Katıl Hayek, which is a couple of thousand years after Göbekli Tepe, that looks like it might have been a place of instruction. And you've got places like Machu Picchu in Peru that look like they might have been places of instruction. That's all falls in the category of things that I can't say definitely yet.
Your book on the Dogon and the reference made to unseen energies are maybe like you say, the individuals who are imbued with this information. How do you, it gets into the realm of fantastic possibilities when you begin to talk like that and focus. And I mean,
well, you were mentioning about Schwaller de Lubitz. The piece that I'm quoting from Schwaller de Lubitz is actually one that John Anthony West sent to me a few years back. He said, there's a name for what you're doing, and Schwaller de Lubitz describes it. And it comes out of Islam. It's a concept called the Bridge of Sirah. And the idea is that when the truth is finally known, it's going to be found to lie on a razor's edge between two chasms, one that represents science and one that represents superstition. And so the idea is that it doesn't matter which perspective you approach this material from, when the truth is finally known, it's going to require you to stretch your belief system just a little bit in order to be able to get your arms around it. And that's sort of where we're at with this, is that anybody who approaches this stuff with a scientific framework is going to have a hard time believing that there's a whole aspect of the universe that we can't see. But we can demonstrate it scientifically. In astrophysics, when we talk about string theory and things like that, there are fundamental particles, maybe 200 fundamental, more than 200 fundamental particles that make up matter. And scientists, astronomers, categorize those particles based on a property called spin, which is essentially tells us what the particle looks like from different angles for different sides. Now, there's one category of particles that looks the same from all sides. There's another category of particles that has to be turned 180 degrees around in order to look the same. There's a third kind that has to be turned 360 degrees all the way around in order to look the same. And there's a fourth category that has to actually be turned around twice in order to look the same. And the only way that happens is if when you spin it once, it somehow goes to a place that we can't see, and you have to spin it the second time to get it back into the realm that we can see. And so you can demonstrate through the existence of that fourth kind of particle that there is a realm out there that we can't see. It's the blind spot, akin to the blind spot in the mirrors of your car that you can hide a tractor trailer in. And for me, as a traditional scientist, makes the rule for himself essentially that it's the same as if you got into your car and made the rule for yourself that the only things you were going to believe were real were the things you could see in the mirrors. But if you do that, you automatically sort of leave out, you eliminate anything that's hidden in that blind spot. And that's the way I think that reality actually works, is that science so far does not really allow for the possibility that there are blind spots.
Fascinating thought. We have a question here from Jim in Santa Fe. It's a Facebook question. He wants to know if you believe the Anunnaki were the major influence. That's all he asks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, no, I don't. Now, that's a complicated answer, because the term Anunnaki has cosmological meaning for the Dogon. The term connects to biology. It connects to the concept of genes and chromosomes. And so there's a level at which you can look at the concept of the Anunnaki as it's given in Sumer or in the texts that explain about the Anunnaki, that you can interpret that entire text as being a statement about biology, not a statement about real life statement about real things that happened in the real world. Now, that's not to say that there might not have been non-humans involved at that time that the term ended up being applied to, but I do know for certain that there's a level on which those references make sense as scientific references, not as purely literal references. And so right now, I don't have a reason to think that the Anunnaki were anything but a cosmological concept, just as there's a level in Dogon culture where the mythical teachers that they call the Nomo can be interpreted as being representative of scientific concepts. I don't entirely buy Robert Temple's theory, the way he presents his theory about an alien contact. I don't align completely with his perspective on that either.
Interesting. In your book, you spend some time discussing the T pillars, the T-shaped pillars, and the symbology in the writing as dual arm and embrace. I'm trying to get, what does that mean, and what's the larger concept of that as it relates to other cultures? I find that fascinating.
When you talk about the formation of matter the way the Dogon understand it, and a lot of these pieces are confirmed in other cultures also, matter starts out as waves with no mass and no acceleration. And an act of perception, according to Heisenberg, if you get down to a small enough particle, a particle that has a small enough amount of mass, the act of perception has to disturb the particle. So when we get down to these matter in its massless, its wave-like state where it has no mass, an act of perception has to disturb the wave, and the only thing it can do is impart a little bit of mass to it. And when it does that, it's akin to slamming on your brakes in a car. It causes vibration to happen all of a sudden, and that vibration draws the wave up and causes it to encircle, and it starts to create little bubbles. You imagine when you start blowing soap bubbles with a little bubble ring, that the first couple that you do, they pop prematurely. They don't form coherent bubbles. You don't have enough of the soap on the ring yet to be able to create a coherent bubble. Well, that's what happens with matter also, that as these tiny bubble-like dimensions form, the first six of them pop. And the seventh one manages to create a coherent enough shape for a period of time to actually count as something in terms of matter, and then it too also eventually bursts. Now, there are two ways of conceptualizing this little bubble. And one is given, I think, from our perspective of the material universe, and that's as these little wrapped up dimensions that are bubbles. But when it's looked at from the perspective of the non-material universe, it's characterized as rays of a star of increasing length, seven rays, and as a spiral that can be drawn to inscribe the endpoints of those rays. Now that spiral is the fundamental unit that matter's based on. It's a tiny little vortex. It connects to something in astrophysics called torsion theory. In torsion theory, the idea is that these tiny little vortices, these tiny little spirals that exist at every point in space and time, create a kind of a suction that is the cause of gravity. Now, according to the cultures I study, the spiral, the arms of the spiral that go around in the circle, are made of mass or matter. But what's in between the arms is something that's akin to light. And so what you've got in that spiral is essentially an embrace between the non-material universe and the material universe. Now, I connected to this concept of the embrace because I kept seeing references to that idea. But what pinned it down for me was that there is an Egyptian word for pillar that also, it's a homonym, it's pronounced just like an Egyptian word that means embrace. And I started exploring other words, Egyptian words that mean either to hug or to embrace, and I discovered that they hit on, they ended up being homonyms for key concepts all up and down the scale in this cosmology, this creation tradition. And so my outlook is that on one of these Göbekli Tepe pillars where we have two arms coming down the side and wrapping hands wrapping around the end of the pillar, that those arms represent the concept of an embrace. And the idea is that it's an embrace between the non-material and the material universes. Now, Göbekli Tepe itself, in the real world, represents that same kind of embrace for me. It's an approach from the non-material side to help the material side. And the symbol they chose, the two symbols they chose to represent themselves to us, are the idea of a mother goddess and the idea of an embrace. You put those two things together, and what you come up with is a hug. About as non-threatening a symbol to approach somebody with as you can think of. You think of Klaatu getting off of the spaceship in Washington, D.C. in War of the Worlds, or in, not War of the Worlds, but in...
yeah, I know, the alien
right,
movie.
The day the Earth stood still.
The day the Earth stood still, yeah.
Yes, he's carrying an implement that looks like it might be a weapon, and then it gets misinterpreted as a weapon, and he gets shot. Whoever it was from the non-material side here who may have made an approach to us was smarter than that. They used as their symbol the concept of a hug, which was the least threatening thing they could think of. And so you have, in archaic times, this lengthy matriarchal tradition that crosses boundaries of cultures everywhere. Everybody has mother goddess this, mother goddess that. From times long, even long before 10,000 BC, you have carved images of mother goddesses. So the non-material side is cast as a feminine principle, and the material side is cast as a masculine principle. And when those two come together, you get something that's the equivalent, a correlate to biological reproduction, where a male element comes together with a female element, creates a fertilized egg that then becomes something. Well, that's the way matter is cast, is being created. These two energies, male and female, come together, and the result is matter.
That's fascinating. In the last few minutes we have here, I have to ask you this, and I haven't asked you this before, Laird. Is it your belief that we are a seeded planet, that we are, our roots are from off-world civilizations, or do you believe in the evolution of the species?
Well, that's also a sort of a two-part answer here. First of all, it looks to me as if the fundamental structure of the universe, as it's described by these cultures that I'm studying, the concept of life, the principle of life, is fundamentally built into even the structure of the way the universes are put together. The universes, as they describe them, are connected to one another in the same way that the same helical design as DNA, basically. So it looks to me as if the principle of life is built right into the structure, that anywhere the conditions are right, life is going to take hold, just like anywhere the conditions are right, a weed is going to grow. Now, given that as a starting point, there's lots of evidence that makes it look as if over the hundreds of thousands of years that humanity has been around, that somebody might have deliberately tweaked some things. And there are lots of things to indicate that. They've done studies, like migration studies, of how populations got to North America, and there's a piece of the genetic puzzle there that they can't assign to any group. There are lots of little suggestive hints that at key points along the line, certain little tweaks may have been made. So I think we may have both. I think that we may have a situation where life is so tenacious that you can't really stop it from arising in situations that would foster it. But I think that also we have a situation where outsiders may have come in and tweaked things for their own purposes. Now, The thing, as a society, we tend to sort of ridicule and deny that, even at a point where we're on the verge ourselves of being able to go out to one of these exo-universes and actually do it. We're still denying that someone's going to come here and that it does.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
So yes,
that is
my answer is I think that the chances are pretty good that we have been tweaked, and yes, I think that life probably would have arisen here anyway because we have the right conditions to foster in.
You said something interesting though, Laird. You said that hundreds of thousands of years, but you focus and reference quite a bit of the Hindu history, and the Vedas go back millions of years, and a number of people I've spoken to who have been on the show, Michael Cremo, for one, believes that modern man has been on the earth millions of years and has started and stopped, either through his own hand or through catastrophic events that may have wiped an act of civilization off the planet of the earth. So,
right. I think it's quite possible that it's cyclical and that it's happened many times before. My problem is that I have ways of tracing evidence to 3000 BC. I have creative ways of tracing it to 10,000 BC. But we get before 10,000 BC, we bump up against the Ice Age, and it's very difficult to anchor an interpretation that goes across that boundary because we don't have evidence to anchor it to. So all of that stuff, even though I believe that there may have been influences that were pre-Ice Age influences on us, I don't have any way of demonstrating it. So
that's true. Until something melts and we get a temple that has some scriptures and...
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
So that's where it sort of stands for me, is I can see the 10,000 BC influences, I can see references to things before 10,000 BC, and I can see influences along the line 7,000 and 3,000 and 1,500 BC and so forth. But so far, I don't have the mechanism to be able to carry that back beyond the Ice Age.
Yes, yes. And without any evidence, you only can speculate, which makes it a challenge. So
right. Beyond that, it's Laird Scrant saying, I think something, it's not based on anything that we could demonstrate as being real. And I don't want to be there. I want to be rooted in something where someone says, why is this so? I want to be able to have an answer to that.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. I tend to agree with you. The book is Point of Origin, Göbekli Tepe and the Spiritual Matrix for the World's Cosmologies. And my guest today has been Laird Scranton. Scranton, I want to ask you where we always ask our guests where they're going to be for the next couple of months or years. What's happening with you? We know you have a book coming out, I guess, in the fall.
Yeah, Point of Origin just out. I have the follow-on to Point of Origin just submitted, so presumably that'll be sometime 2016. And I'm maybe a seventh of the way through the next manuscript beyond that, so there'll be another book in 2017. I'm scheduled now to speak to a MUFON group in Philadelphia on the 15th of September, and I'm scheduled to speak at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis the first weekend in October. I think it's the second, third, and fourth
Very
of
good.
October.
Okay, and
things turn up.
Go ahead. What's your website?
I don't actually have one. There is a LairdScranton.com that is a fan site that does connect, like the contact tab connects to me, and I answer emails and messages that are sent from there. But it's actually not my site. The books can all be found at all the usual outlets. I think Point of Origin is actually in all the Barnes & Noble stores right now, which is great. And you can find them at my publisher's site, innertraditions.com. You can find them at simonandschuster.com. You can find them on Amazon or any of the usual online bookstores. And you can you may find them on the shelf in a given bookstore. Our local bookstore, I discovered, was carrying my China book, and I didn't realize they were just an independent bookstore.
Okay, and real quickly, what's this new book on? Is it it's another continuation on a Point of Origin? I'm sorry, I think you mentioned.
I'm calling it the Overthrown Boat, and I'm not sure whether the publisher will keep that title. My working title for Point of Origin was Point of Origin, and it was sort of a back and forth to try to get them to agree to use it, but that's the title the material sort of called for. The new book calls for the title the Overthrown Boat. The focus of it is on northern Scotland, and in specific on a little Neolithic village called Scarabray in northern Scotland. And The upshot of it is that it demonstrates how that region of the world folds into the same system of cosmology that I've been chasing in Africa and India and Egypt and China and places like that.
Fascinating. Well, I must say you're a prolific writer, and each of your books is a fascinating look at our ancient past, and that's why I enjoy having you on the program. So thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, because I really enjoy these conversations and the opportunity to explain things a little bit.
Yes, yes, appreciate it. So that was our show today. Do check out Laird's book. It's now available. I just saw it on Amazon, and all his other books are there, too. They're quite in-depthly researched, well looked into the past, and that's what we're all about, Earth Ancients. That's it for today, and we will talk to you again next week.